Killer Innovations Podcast for Sunday, July 10th, 2005, show number 18, brought to you from Washington, D.C. Hello, this is Phil McKinney, and welcome to this week's Killer Innovations Podcast. Before we go on, I have to, as usual, give the disclaimer. The opinions expressed in this podcast are mine and mine alone, and do not necessarily reflect those of my past, current, or future employers. For those of you who are regular listeners, you know that I'm just coming off of vacation. I don't know about you, but I always find the weekend at the end of the vacation to kind of be that transition period, trying to get yourself ramped up or at least get mentally ramped up to get back into the normal work schedule. And so that's what I'm doing this weekend, is trying to get ready for the start of yet another work week and coming off of vacation. Thanks for all the comments that have come in. I'm a little behind in responding to emails. Hopefully I'll be able to get back and respond to everybody early this week. Also, we're going to be making some additional changes to the ID3 tags in the MP3 audio files that you download based on some feedback from some listeners last week. For those of you who are new listeners, the first show in July, which was last week's show, we made some radical changes to the ID3 tags to make it easier for you to search and find information about the MP3 files, also to make it easier and more informative when the information is displayed on your MP3 player. And also, we've made some significant changes in the RSS feed in support of iTunes. So, if you can take a moment, look down at your MP3 player, or if you're running this off of your PC and listening to it, look at the screen display. And let me know, how does it look? Is the information informative? Is it helpful? Whatever. So drop me a note and let me know. Also, please continue to send in your feedback, questions, suggested topics for future shows, any comments you might have. You can reach me at by email at podcast@killerinnovations.com or on the feedback line 1-703-636-4460 or on Skype at Phil_McKinney. Let's go ahead and jump right into segment number one. In response to a number of questions from show number 16, where we talked about the process of how do you measure innovation, measure that your innovation, your structured innovation process is working, generated a natural follow-on question that came in from a number of listeners about the area around, is there a set of metrics that allow you to target innovation investment? Can you look early in the innovation process or early in the commercialization process of an idea or innovation and determine if this one is going to be the winner? Well, there's no sure way to pick a winner. If you look at innovations that have gone on to become wildly successful, things that have fundamentally changed the entire industry, such as video processors, you know, for those of us who've been around long enough, you know, recalling when the IBM PC was first introduced in 1983, the whole concept of having a separate processor in the machine just to drive high-resolution graphics was not even on the radar screen. Yet you look at the marketplace today for like NVIDIA and others out there creating literally a $1 billion market segment that was not on the concepts or even on the roadmap for any of the major PC players. Others would include things like iPod or even network technology such as Cisco, or for those of us from the modem days, companies like US Robotics. If you look at these that have become wildly successful, you can derive a basic set of criteria beyond just the uniqueness of the idea, but a set of criteria that allows you to at least identify and understand what criteria or what characteristics the winners should have in order to be very successful. For this podcast, I'm going to talk about the financial criteria that I use to identify potential killer innovations. I have the opportunity to look at a lot of early stage startup companies, early stage technologies, and again, these are tied to high tech companies that I get involved in as part of my day-to-day job. But you can derive this a similar criteria for whatever that industry may be, including, heavy manufacturing, mining exploration, professional services, whatever the case might be. But what I'm going to share with you is the criteria that I use. And this criteria isn't just about looking at the past, meaning, after the innovation is wildly successful, hindsight being 2020, but that you can use this to set up gates or flags that can then be used to say that this one is on track, or this potential idea or this potential innovation is on track to fundamentally have a huge impact in the marketplace. So the financial criteria that I look at is a couple of key ones. And again, this was derived by looking at historically back a number of years into ideas or technologies that fundamentally created entirely new market segments. These were truly killer innovations. So what are these criteria? One, the idea or innovation has to provide access to a significant revenue pool, potential source of revenue. And the criteria that I typically use is I'm looking for ideas or innovations that will have access to a revenue pool greater than $1 billion. Now, sometimes this is hard to predict, particularly when it's a new category, but for the kind of innovations that are going to have fundamental breakthroughs, create entirely new market segments, you need to be looking at revenue pools greater than $1 billion, at least in the space that I'm looking for. Now, in your segment, it might be $100 million, whatever the case might be. So keep in mind that what I'm talking about are high tech innovations that are truly killer breakout kind of innovations. Second criteria, it has to be cash flow positive once its revenue hits 25 to 30 million US. Now, why is that? Well, one is that the idea or innovation needs to be able to generate enough cash to fund the ongoing development. And also, this forces management to create market value that results in the positive gross margins early in the commercialization. I run across a lot of companies who have very interesting technologies, and they have, 10 reference customers, but none of those reference customers are actually paying for that technology or for that innovation. And so therefore, the idea of that this is going to be wildly successful is immediately suspect. It isn't the fact that 10 companies are using it, but that they're willing to pay for it, and they're willing to pay a premium for it, which means that there's a high amount of value that the customers perceive in this technology or in this innovation. So again, cash flow positive once the idea, innovation, new startup, whatever the case might be, hits revenue of 25 to 30 million US. The third criteria is that the entity or company or division needs to be EBITDA positive beyond 50 million in revenue. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with the financial reporting for public companies, and this also applies to private companies, you need to become quickly familiar with what EBITDA stands for: earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. And what does EBITDA show you? EBITDA means or proves out that that you have a disciplined management team that's not allowing costs to get out of control during the what I would call the go-go growth days. This is kind of the new unit of measure put in place post the dot-com implosion. So if a company's actually able to generate positive EBITDA numbers, then that shows you that they have a cost structure in place. This includes labor cost, SG&A, other costs that that can scale to support a high growth business. Companies that have a hard time getting to EBITDA positive basically is saying that expenses are far outstripping the revenue stream, and therefore it's going to become very hard to reinvest into organizations, etc., to support a potential killer innovation. Fourth criteria is consistent gross margins from $100 million up to $1 billion in revenue for a given product or given innovation. Now, this is one of the key criterias that I use and many others use in order to determine if this idea or this innovation really has legs. Is this something that fundamentally is going to drive significant impact, significant upside potential for the industry? And what kind of gross margins do I look for? Well, it depends on what technology I'm looking at. For instance, if it's in, let's say, the software space, I'm looking for consistent gross margins of somewhere in the 70% to 80% range. Again, this is for revenue north of $100 million going to $1 billion, and that margin is going to be consistent throughout that revenue growth curve. For hardware, it's probably about half of that, you know, something in the 30% to 40% range in the hardware space. If you're in other industries other than high tech, you should research the leaders to see what your target should be. So look at the leaders in your given segment and determine what kind of gross margin targets you should have. And why is gross margin so important? Well, for one, it's really the proof point that the technology innovation has staying power. It has a high barrier to entry, meaning that you've got the unique position, customers are willing to pay the price premium. There's therefore a reduced risk of competition, ultimately leading to the point that the fact that you have minimal risk to a price war. So this gross margin is one way from a financials perspective to see if a technology truly has differentiation and truly has barrier to entry from other competitions. And since the margins are high, that again just reinforces the fact that the customers are willing to pay that price premium. So again, this is not foolproof. You know, this is just one more tool you can use when evaluating your ideas, or if you're trying to raise money or convince investors or to recruit senior management teams or to recruit board of directors or advisors that your idea or your innovation truly has this upside potential, is to look at these kinds of criteria. One, do you provide access to a significant revenue pool? In the case of the criteria that I look for, is it more than $1 billion? Two, is it or will you be cash flow positive once you get into the range of $25 to $30 million in revenue? Three, are you going to be EBITDA positive beyond $50 million in revenue and remain EBITDA positive once you've hit $50 million in revenue? Do you have consistent gross margins when you get above $100 million and all the way up to $1 billion in revenue? And again, that gross margin range varies depending on technologies or innovations, but it should be consistent and should stay in place during that entire growth curve from $1 million to $1 billion as your idea or innovation truly moves into this category of being a killer innovation. And with that, let's go ahead and move into segment two. In this segment, we're going to expand on what we did in show 16 and share with you how to apply the killer innovation approach by using a real company as an example. In show 16, we shared with you the story of Black and Decker and how they literally started off, you know, two partners with literally very diverse backgrounds to literally build the market leader in a given space. So for this week's example of Killer Innovations, let's take a step back in time again and let's talk about Henry. Henry was born in 1898 in China, where his father was a Presbyterian minister and a missionary. Henry spent his entire childhood in China, emerging from that experience in China with a deep sense of moral conviction. Given that your father is a minister and a missionary, that's to be expected. Huge amount of ambition. He saw what was going on in the world, saw the opportunities, particularly in the U.S., and he had, you know, limitless curiosity. He was always looking into new things, what was going on in other parts of the world. He read insatiably, and he developed almost an obsessive attraction to travel. And so it was this thirst of knowledge and experience that helped determine really where Henry was going to go in the future and what his future career was going to be. After graduating from Yale in 1920, Henry spent a year in England studying at Oxford before returning to the U.S. where he took a job as a reporter. It was during that time that Henry, along with a fellow Yale alum named Britton Hayden, they drew up the plans for a new kind of weekly magazine. And this plan was really focused on a magazine that wouldn't simply report the news, but would also interpret it for those who did not have the time, the energy, or really the knowledge to interpret it for themselves. And they designed this new publication to be read in less than an hour. The leading journalists, editors, and authors that were leaders in the industry at that time proclaimed that it would never work, you know. But the two partners remained convinced, and they raised a total of $86,000 to launch their new venture. And with a staff of only themselves and three other full-time writers, they published the first issue of Time Magazine on March 3, 1923. Now, Time quickly attracted a growing readership, and amazingly enough, it doubled its circulation within the first year. And one of the major reasons for the magazine's success was its uniqueness. Unlike other periodicals, which tended to be more literary, you know, longer articles, etc., Time was an urgent, news-driven summary of the week's events, and it was written in a very distinctive style. Now, as we've talked in the past, the whole concept of killer innovations is that you need to have this level of uniqueness, something that completely breaks ties with how things were done in the past. Now, in this case, with Henry and his partner, they building on their earliest success, they went on to create, one, Fortune magazine. Now, a little interesting, you know, tidbit about Fortune. Fortune was launched in February of 1930. Now think about it, February 1930. That was shortly after thousands of fortunes had instantly disappeared in a stock market crash. Now, despite its unfortunate timing, Fortune was a huge success through its heavily researched content aimed at a very specific niche market that was not served at the time. And that market was the business community and entrepreneurs of the time. Now, following the success at Fortune, Henry went on and founded Life magazine, which was launched in 1936. And by innovating the use of photojournalism, Henry used marvelous photographs and snappy captions to create a unique publication. Its success was cemented when it ran out of its initial print run of 446,000 copies, the largest first issue printing in magazine history at that time. And just to kind of give you a scale of the success of Henry Luce's vision, was at the time of his death in 1967, Life had a circulation of 750 million, and time had a circulation of 350 million. So think about it. From the 1930s, 1967, Henry Luce and his vision was able to see just an absolute phenomenal growth, and literally the formation of an entirely new segment of the publication industry, which was basically the news weeklies. Now, Henry Luce is credited with innovating many of the techniques that now have become standard journalistic practices. One, he was the first publisher to emphasize personalities in writing. Up until that point, all the writing and publications was pretty dry and basically stuck to the facts. Henry Luce was the first one really to bring the personalities of the subjects of the articles into the writing process. Number two, at time, he started the concept of group journalism by introducing the reporter, researcher, writer teams. So rather than just having one person sit down and do all the research and all the writing and all the editing for a given article, Henry Luce was the one who brought together specialties or specializations around these teams in order to create the kinds of articles that we now see in Time magazine. And at Life, he created basically the photographer-writer teams, where the photograph took center stage rather than the writing. So, what was the killer question that unlocked this innovation for Henry Luce? Well, the basic question that Henry Luce was facing at the time was what are the basic assumptions under which, in this case, the printing, publishing, journalism industry operates under? And was Henry Luce willing to go against those industry norms? So again, the killer question that Henry Luce was facing was what changes or how could he radically change the basic assumptions under the wood in which the industry operates? And when he looked at all of those basic assumptions, what was it that he could change to fundamentally give him a unique position in the marketplace and address a growing need, or what he perceived as an unmet need in the marketplace? Now, Henry Luce took great risks to grow his titles. Now, when Life debuted, it became an instant blockbuster. The cost of printing 1 million copies per week surpassed revenue. Not a good thing, given what we just discussed in segment one, with regards to some of the financial criteria to identify the underpinnings for killer innovations. And so the company really started losing millions of dollars, and this is a case where success may not have been a good thing. However, fear of alienating his subscribers, Luce refused to scale back production or alter the quality of the magazine. Instead, he went to his printer and paper suppliers and asked them to help him find more efficient publishing methods. Now, in many cases, more efficient publishing methods for those partners would obviously translate potentially into lower margins, lower revenue, and therefore became, possibly not something that they were encouraged to do. What Henry Luce did is he went to them with this urgent need and guaranteed them a fair margin of profit despite Time Inc.'s losses. And so therefore, rather than treating them just as a normal supplier, he literally brought them, into the fold and treated them as literally equal partners in the success of Time magazine, or in this case, Life magazine. Now, in this case, this breakthrough partnering approach worked. By 1939, Life had not only become profitable, but it was the most widely circulated magazine in the world. So again, what was the killer question for Henry Luce that unlocked this key understanding in order to make sure that Life magazine was profitable, and therefore his success would translate into the financial successes that you expect with the killer innovation? Well, the first one was, is what if I realign my relationships? Most businesses look at their suppliers as clearly just as vendors, and that they are a commodity and can easily be swapped out with others. But in this case, Henry Luce went to his printers and paper suppliers, and Lilly brought them in as partners. And again, not as suppliers, but as partners. And through that process, created basically a lot of the innovations that you see in the Newsweekly magazines, such as double fold printing, center stapling, other innovations that just did not exist at the time. I think there was a second question, though, that was in the back of Henry Luce's mind when he was working on this also. And this was obviously the underlying driver, which was, what would it take to make my product at half the cost it is today? Now, many times we look at reducing costs by 5 or 10%. But in the case of really forcing killer, those killer ideas, is you have to take a radical step, change the fundamental model or fundamental economics. In this case, what would it take to make my product, in this case, Life magazine, at half the cost? Now, Henry Luce also had an additional criteria on that, which was without sacrificing the quality. So, what would it take to make my product at half the cost without sacrificing the quality? And this forces you to look at very creative approaches to unlocking the cost in producing whatever the product or services that you're working on, in this case, Life magazine. So, in Henry Luce's vision in creating magazines that would explain and interpret really the complex events of the day to a much broader audience than typically read magazines or read newspapers. So his vision for creating these kinds of magazines led to what we would call news analysis. There's news reporting and there's news analysis. It was Henry Luce's innovation for Time Magazine, for Fortune Magazine, for Life Magazine that led to the concept or the innovation of news analysis as opposed to straight reporting. And it changed journalism forever. So let's go on to segment three, the killer question of the week. One skill that many find difficult to leverage when they're searching for that killer innovation is in the process of changing their perspective. We all come to a given industry, business, career with a given perspective, based on where we were raised, our education level, our marital status, whatever. But changing a perspective can unlock new ideas. And one way to unlock this skill is to take on the persona of someone else. So the killer question for this week is, can you substitute someone else's perspective for yours? And how would they approach your product or service? So again, the killer question of the week is, can you substitute someone else's perspective for yours? And how would they approach your product, service, problem, opportunity? So you literally become that person, take on their thinking and decision-making style, and then apply and think about it from their perspective and come up with a set of ideas or a set of answers to what you're working on. Some possible thought leaders that you may want to consider would be Walt Disney. I'm a big Walt Disney fan, and I think you read a few of Walt's biographies and you quickly understand kind of his unique thinking style and how he applied it. I know people who are big into Leonardo da Vinci and thinking about the process that he went through in creating or coming up with his ideas. Steve Jobs at Apple. Steve has some very unique thinking styles and some very unique approaches. So if you're working on, let's say, a consumer electronics product, put your Steve Jobs hat on, and how would Steve approach your product or your technology or service? What would Thomas Edison say about your product or service? Try multiple thought leaders. Gain those multiple perspectives. Don't get bogged down into thinking about just one perspective. Gain multiple perspectives. You never know. It might be, quote, this someone else, this virtual individual who unlocks that killer innovation that you're really looking for. And with that, we are going to wrap up this week's show. I want to thank everybody for listening. Hopefully you found the information shared helpful and beneficial. Please keep the comments coming in. Again, you can reach me at email address of podcast@killerinnovations.com. You can also reach me on Skype at Phil_McKinney. Let's see, what else? Don't forget to vote. Go out to podcastalley.com. You can also visit the killerinnovations.com website and vote there. But it's important that you go out to Podcast Alley and vote for your favorite podcast. As I've said in previous podcasts, going out and posting a comment on those sites and voting is the easiest way for you to let the producers of your favorite podcast know that you do appreciate the effort and time that they put in to producing them. And also share the podcast with others. If you find it useful, if you find it beneficial to the work that you're doing in your business, one, I would love to hear about it, and two, share it with others. Killer Innovations Podcast has enjoyed a recent burst of additional listeners. A lot of that is coming from iTunes now that we are listed on the iTunes store. So for those of you who are new listeners, welcome. Again, I thank you for listening. Let's see, where will I be next week? I'll actually be in Roanoke, Virginia next weekend. So that's probably where I'll be producing next week's podcast. But in the meantime, if you have any questions, comments, feedbacks, please don't hesitate to drop me an email. And again, I thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.